I'll move the Health and Human Services Finance Committee to order. Representative Finstad, would you be willing to move the minutes of the Thursday, March 4th meeting?
So moved.
Any questions or comments, changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We're going to modify because of one of our guests has a meeting to get to, so we're going to move to House File 1804, Representative Samuelson's bill first. Representative Samuelson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1804 to be held over for inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. Representative Samuelson moves House File 1804, and we'll handle later. Representative Samuelson, would you like to present your bill and present testimony?
Thank you. What the bill basically does is ask for a rate increase for a skilled nursing facility in Ramsey County, basically Ramsey County Nursing Home. And Victoria Reiner, the commissioner, is here to discuss the issue.
Welcome, committee. Commissioner, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Reinhart. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, Chair of the County Board, and I thank you for allowing us to go first since I have a County Board meeting to chair it in a little while. And I also represent, excuse me, the Commissioner District in which the Ramsey County Nursing Home is located in Maplewood. Basically, as Representative Samuelson has said, what we're asking for is a daily rate increase of $4.98 per bed, and that is to fill the current funding gap of $327,000. The increased rate will, of course, raise that amount. The sources of the dollars would be approximately divided by three, $109,000 from the federal government, from the state government, and from private payers. And so the state in the $327,000, what we're asking for is $109,000. I would like to point out that one other consideration regarding the dollar amount is that the state of Minnesota earns $1.6 million in federal revenue through the intergovernmental transfer with the Ramsey Nursing Home because it is publicly owned and operated, so we would really like to see this continue. The Ramsey Nursing Home, we feel, is important to the continuum of services for a number of reasons for senior citizens. The occupancy rate at this nursing home has averaged 99% over the last 10 years. It's consistently been one of the highest rated nursing homes in the state. Basically, we always have a waiting list. In the last 2 years, 50% of the admissions have come from referrals from other nursing homes. And one of the things that tells you is that we are really dealing with some of the people that have a great deal of behavioral problems and really need a lot of extra attention. The rate of residents with some form of dementia is 61%, and that compares to the state average of 41%. Again, very high skilled workers are needed to deal with the case mix that's at our nursing home. The average length of stay is 2.28 years, and many homes average less than 6 months. And so what I'm trying to do is paint a picture for you of why this nursing home is really very unique. Now, you may very well ask, why is the nursing home experiencing financial difficulty at this point? Well, it's the range of rates for all nursing homes in Minnesota varies between $83 to $241 per day. The current rate at the nursing home is $155.08 and falls, of course, in the middle of that range. But this is really comparing apples and oranges. The more accurate comparison with other nursing homes would be with those that have similar case mixes, and we will be working with the Department of Human Services to produce a comparison of the rates of the homes with the same case mix level. But the higher difficulty of care requires a skill level from the staff that is reflected in the rates. The Ramsey County Board also continues to support the nursing home with approximately $300,000 annually in property taxes. What happens if the Ramsey Nursing Home closes? There are a limited number of beds open in the metro area, and again, given the case mix and the severity of the the residents that we are, or the skill level needed for the residents that we're caring for, it's very unlikely that they would be able to find nursing home beds in the metropolitan area, if even outside of that. The money that from the rate increase would be used to pay for the increased operating expenses like heat, electricity, and water. There's also obviously needed regular equipment replacement, including beds. Therapy costs for speech, occupational, and physical therapy are, of course, going up. And as we all know, the increased cost of providing health care or health insurance coverage is going crazy. And we have to deal, of course, with the already negotiated contracts. We have Pat Reller, who is the nursing home administrator, with us today. And I can also stand for questions. And if I'm not able to answer them, we can ask Pat to come up.
Thank you. I didn't have indication. Oh, first of all, any questions? Seeing none. I had an indication that Chris Cohen wanted to testify, or is it just to be available in case there's questions?
It's my understanding that he did want to testify.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Chris Cowan, and I'm a lobbyist on behalf of AFSCME. And in this case, representing most of the folks that work in that nursing home. And just briefly, I'd like to put into the record that we agree with the county in that we believe this funding is important. We believe that nursing home provides quality service now and has for a long, long time. And just briefly, we support this bill.
Thank you. Representative Sanderson, any additional testifiers?
Maybe possibly Pat Reller, the administrator from the home, would be interested in testifying.
Yeah, I suggest our time is tight with lots of bills, and I think you've presented the case, so if we can make it fairly brief, I'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Good morning. I really don't have a lot to add other than the fact that Ramsey County Nursing Home has been on that campus since 1885 and does provide excellent care. Our customer satisfaction surveys have rated over 95% in the last 3 years, and we have 98% of our clients and families saying that they are very supportive of our care. We've also had an excellent reputation with the Minnesota Department of Health and have not had any major deficiencies with them at a G level. So we are very proud of the nursing home. We believe we provide excellent care, and we believe that the county has been very good in managing and supporting us, and we believe the fact that we do get that intergovernmental transfer money would be a loss to the state of Minnesota if Ramsey Nursing Home were to close. Thank you.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your name? We missed.
It's Patricia Reller, R-E-L-L-E-R, and I'm the administrator, and I've been there for almost 11 years.
So just a question for you. The increase is by the language for operating costs. And I know that there's been some contract negotiations and so forth going on. And it was mentioned that this is for some of the operating expense like the heat and liability insurance and so forth. Now, can we be sure of where the money would actually be used and that it wouldn't have some bearing on any contract negotiations?
The intent is to use it for operating costs exclusive of contracts. So we're not looking at using it for wages and benefits at this time.
Thank you very much. And if I may also, although we don't have a formal fiscal note, the amount of 327 or 328, but I believe that's taking all of the beds, 180 beds times the $5, which you must have some proportion of private pay that we wouldn't be participating in.
Yes, we have approximately about 25% private pay.
So,
but, and also Medicare. So we looked at it that it would be a third, third, and third as far as the split goes, the state, the federal, and then the private and Medicare.
And so that would likely be then just something over $100,000 is probably what this would be.
Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Okay. See none. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one. The chair will lay over House File 1804 for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Broad, House File 1977. I'll move House File 1977 and Representative Bobrovitz, you can tell me if this needs to go to any other committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not that has been requested at this time.
Okay. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, what the bill does is that it transfers $75,000 from the unclaimed lottery prize fund to an organization called the National Association, or excuse me, the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance that is located in Arlington, Minnesota. And as we all know, gambling has been given much attention here in the state of Minnesota and actually throughout the country. And I just have some people here today to talk to you a little bit about the North Star Alliance and to answer any specific questions. I have Don Feeney, actually from the lottery, here to answer any specific questions, who's also a board member of the North Star Alliance. I have Reverend Lance Holthusen, the executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance, and Marjorie Rapp, another board member and an attorney here in St. Paul. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Holthusen to touch quickly on the alliance itself.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Lance Holthusen. I'm the executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. Mr. Chair and members of this committee, a few comments about the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance and this particular bill. This is really a very important bill, I think, for a number of reasons. The North Star Alliance is a gambling neutral private nonprofit entity that as a governmental entity, can do some things that government cannot do. I think the most important thing that we need to note is that it is representative of all of the stakeholders and gatekeepers in the arena of gambling. And by stakeholders, I mean all of the gambling venues, the Minnesota State Lottery, Canterbury Park, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association, the Independent Tribal Communities of Minnesota, Allied Charities of Minnesota, as well as people from the financial services industry, the bench, people from treatment, both the residential treatment providers as well as independent outpatient treatment providers, and stakeholders, those people who hold a key to providing help when there is a problem identified, such as clergy, school counselors, probation officers, people who have that real short window of time that presents itself where a referral for services can be provided. There is not another entity that includes representation from all of those areas, which is, and it's very important that there is, where all of the stakeholders can come to the same table, and given their differences, and we all know, and we've heard in testimonies before other committees, the differences of opinion that one gambling venue might have in contrast with another, which is all well and good, but the commonality that brings these people to the same table is the, pardon me, is the concern for the problem gambler. That is our single mission, to provide service for the problem gambler and those people who are affected by problem gambling. There are a couple of people who are with me this morning who I think can also provide some insight into the uniqueness of the organization and challenges that we're attempting to respond to. I'd like to introduce Marjorie Rapp, who is the principal with the Bridgeport Family Law Center in St. Paul, and an attorney, and she has a few comments to make about both her experiences with and the work of the committee that she chairs for us in that regard. Marjorie?
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Marjorie Rapp, and as Lance has already said, I do practice law in St. Paul in the area of family law and criminal defense concerning children. And I'd like to talk a minute on two things that I think the judicial system has not yet addressed. Two questions that they haven't answered is, what is the effect of gambling, of problem gambling, on our families and our communities, and how do we address those problems? One of the things that in 5 years of practice that I've experienced over and over again, and I can honestly say that 90% of the clients that come my way are affected by untreated addiction, and gambling being one of them. And the results of that is divorce, child neglect and abuse, and suicide, mental health, especially depression, and problems where they get into with crime around financial affairs. And I take it very seriously, because I think if these issues aren't addressed by our judicial system, that we often miss what that one call for help that these families need. North Star is now in the process of, we're creating a judicial task force with members from the bench, members from our community, and others to look at the possibility of creating a gambling court, just as we now have a drug court set up in the adult system and in juvenile, that when people come into the system, they would be assessed for these problems and referred to the proper channels for help. So the work that we're doing, I think, is critical. As you may know, gambling is kind of the accepted addiction, so to speak. It's not been addressed as much as alcoholism and other addictions have been, and we're now starting to see the effects of what it has done in our communities and to each other. So we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the second person that I would like to introduce is Don Feeney, who is the director of research and planning for the Minnesota State Lottery.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. Don Feeney, research director, Minnesota State Lottery, for the record. I recognize the limitations on your time, and I'll keep my remarks brief. I think the question that I've been asked most often on this is, why is there a need for this new organization? And I think what happened, there are a number of us who are working in this field who found that there were a number of needs that were not being addressed and that were really very difficult to address through the existing State Department of Human Services structure. The Department of Human Services does an excellent job of making treatment available to anyone who's in need of it, making sure that the treatment is paid for, making sure that people know about that treatment option and have access to it. They have gone from 6 treatment providers several years ago to now over 80, which is an outstanding accomplishment. They have the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week hotline that people, anybody can call to get referrals or just information. And they have done some very nice work in the public awareness field. What we do is a focus on educating people who need to know more about problem gambling than they do, family physicians, ministers, mental health workers who have not had training in addictions, need to know what it is, what this problem is, and how to deal with it when they see it. You'll notice that it's been handed out the brochure for a conference that is actually being held Friday, the second statewide problem gaming conference that we have run. We picked that up after the Department of Human Services decided not to continue having problem gambling related conferences. We're bringing in international experts to come speak to Minnesotans who may have to deal with the problem gambler in their practice at some point in the future. We're putting out a newsletter. We distributed our first newsletter to over 4,000 individuals. Again, the same sorts of gatekeepers and other interested citizens. The Department of Human Services sponsored a newsletter. They dropped that several years ago to budget constraints. We've been able to pick that up. We're also, I think, able to bring in groups that are not comfortable, for whatever reason, working with state agencies. They are willing to work with a nonprofit and work cooperatively. We've had some very, very generous support, for example, from the tribal communities. They are the main sponsors of the conference on Friday, which, by the way, is in St. Paul, and if anyone would like to stop by, we'd certainly love to see you there. I should also add that Mr. Vekic, the acting director of the lottery, is fully supportive of this legislation. And I think with that, we'll see if anybody has any questions on this.
Representative Bond?
Mr. Chair, thank you again. And in summary, I just wanted to say that this bill is not an intent to duplicate services. I think we ought to always ask the question, are we doing that, making sure that we're efficiently using taxpayers' dollars. So this is not an attempt to duplicate what happens at DHS. It's an attempt to supplement that. And I think it's important to say that. It's also really a unique group of people sitting at the table together. And I'm really excited about this group. And so with that, we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Huthelson, let me ask a question I think I asked in my office, and that is, with the partnership that is part of the North Star Alliance, why not go to the partners for the
$75,000? That's indeed part of our intent. However, one of the things that we feel we need to do to begin that process is to have a jump start and be able to provide some incentive for them to participate. One of the things that's been very difficult for all of the concerns that are relating to problem gambling issues is to involve the gambling venue community in funding programs of this nature. And while we have made some headway in that area and been able to have some sponsorship of some individual programs, we really haven't had the kind of response that we think is appropriate. And we think that this would help to motivate a much greater response. The other point that I think needs to be made in that area is I've lost the point.
Can I jump in, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
It's also important to note this is contingent upon matching non-state funds. So it's an opportunity to leverage money from the state with equal amount of non-state money. So it's essentially appropriated in two chunks of 37.5, as long as the organization provides that in non-state money as well.
Now, and let me make it clear, I mean, I haven't had a chance to visit with you. I think I have all the respect in the world for the way you brought together kind of an unusual collection of partners in the work that you do. But although the University of Minnesota is mentioned, just another question, a week or two ago, and time flies, I'm not even sure exactly when, but we had a visit from Dr. Kim at the University of Minnesota, who I think sort of opened a lot of our eyes to at least one of the treatment alternatives for people who are truly in the compulsive end. Are you at all connected to that work?
Don, would you comment on
Mr.
that?
Payne?
We have an article in our newsletter, which you all have in front of you, which is an interview with him.
Mr. Payne.
Mr. Chairman, I have known Dr. Kim for about 8 years, I believe. I've worked with him fairly closely over that period of time. One of our board members, Dr. Winters from the University of Minnesota Medical School, his office is right down the hall from Dr. Kim, deals with him regularly. I am incredibly supportive of his work. His partner at the time actually addressed the statewide conference last year. He's someone that we would look forward to working with very closely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and I have a couple of questions for Mr. Feeney. Could you clarify to me what your position is at the lottery and what your position is at North Star Gambling Alliance? And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I am the Research and Planning Director at the Minnesota State Lottery, and I am a member of the Board of Directors of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance.
Representative Huntley?
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Feeney, do you have a position with the National Council on Problem Gambling?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, yes, I'm in under the Board of Directors of the National Council on Problem Gambling.
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Feeney, are you aware that the National Council on Problem Gambling is under a federal court order?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I am, well aware that the National Council has entered into a consent decree with the Department of Justice, yes.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Feeney, and are you aware that that revolves around past antitrust activities of the National Council on Problem Gambling?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I actually have a copy of the consent decree with me. Yes, I'm aware of that. I also know that those were business practices that had ceased several years before I joined the board. Had those practices continued, I would not have joined the board.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Feeney, so you work for the lottery. You're on the board of a group that's going to get lottery money, and you're also on the board of a national group to which the state group belongs, and they're under a court order. So I guess I'm wondering about the propriety of a lottery employee being on the board of a group that's going to get lottery money and also belonging to a national group that's under a court order.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I'm not clear on the legal distinction. I'm not an attorney. I'm not clear on the legal distinction between a court order and a consent decree, although I believe that they are, at least to some degree, different. If it is believed that there is an issue with the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance receiving money from the state, and if my participation on that board represents a conflict of interest, I will resign from that board. I personally do not believe that there is a conflict of interest. I believe there is a confluence of interest. I think that it is very important that the Minnesota State Lottery and other gambling venues take an active role in this issue, take an active interest in this issue, so that if nothing else, if we're indulging in any practices that are harming the problem gambler in any way, that we are aware of that and we can make any, whatever effort is necessary to cease that. Likewise, I find it very important that the lottery, both the Minnesota State Lottery and the gambling and lottery industry in general, have a line of communication, have a voice on the board of the primary national organization that deals with problem gambling. I'm the only person from a lottery who has ever been elected to that board. In fact, I'm the only person from state government up until about a month or so ago who has ever been elected to that board. I'm very proud of that fact. I don't see that as a conflict. I see it, as far as the state of Minnesota is concerned, as an asset. Again, if there is disagreement with that, I will act accordingly.
My observation would be that Mr. Feeney doesn't gain any personal benefit in terms of dollars out of it, and it's not unusual, I think, even in this body, for people to have associations with various causes and so forth. So although I think it's maybe an information that's fine for the committee to be aware of. Representative Wilkin?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Hunter, can I have you? Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just a comment. I'm not sure what Representative Huntley's comments were getting at, because you know, Mr. Feeney clearly stated that he got on the board after the problem behavior ceased, and frankly, I think it's admirable to join a board that's gone through some rocky times, and we need people that are willing to step in and be the ones to clean things up. So from my standpoint, thank you, Mr. Feeney. I appreciate your willingness to do that and give get an organization some credibility.
Is there any additional testimony that anyone wishes to make? Paul Pets?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is for Representative Broad or one of the other folks or even you, Mr. Chair. What I don't see here is a budget that describes exactly what the money is going to be spent on. Is it just to sort of a general fund that they'll use it for the current staff or current projects, or is it for a set of new things? You know, typically we'd see some sort of a spreadsheet that would be holding people accountable to what we might expect. For example, you list your research as one of the items that would be done. Well, what kind of research are you going to be doing? And so I'm just curious if there is some more material that would describe in detail what the money is actually going to be spent on.
Who would like to respond?
Representative Brock? Lance Holfus and the Executive Director.
Oh, sure. Paul Susan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Opitz, we certainly can provide more detail on a specific budget. The in general terms, the monies would be used for operating expenses, for research startup activities. I think the reference to the work that Dr. Kim is doing at the university is a good example. The unfortunate thing is that the need for that kind of research is sorely underfunded, and one of the activities that we would be involved with would be trying to advocate for and motivate and do work on obtaining greater research funds for the likes of Dr. Kim and others at the University of Minnesota. University of Minnesota has one of the finest research entities in the country dealing with problem gambling, but it is one of the most underfunded of those. Continuing to develop and expand the newsletter is another activity that would be continued. The development of training opportunities for some of the stakeholders and gatekeeper communities that are not being addressed by any other program at this point. There is some work being done in public information and training, but certainly not enough. It's important to realize for this committee, and I think all of the committees that are evaluating programs like this for the state, the area of gambling, and specifically problem gambling issues, is new. Gambling has been around for a long, long time. But in comparison, for example, to drugs and alcohol, where we have a track record of some 80 to 90 years of good experience and increasing experience in research and practice, in the area of gambling, it isn't that way. We have, by comparison, 1/9 to 1/10 of the experience and the amount of research that has gone on.
Excuse me, Mr. Holthausen,
yes,
if I may, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think the question, and I think as a chair I'd like to see this, is all we're asking for is could we get a more of a detailed budget accounting?
Absolutely.
It's going to be $150,000, so if you could give us a breakdown of where those are going to go. We understand the general areas, but I think we're asking for more of a specific.
Absolutely.
Can we get that?
Yes.
All right. Now I'll get that and we'll distribute to the committee. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, we'll hold over. The chair will hold over House File 1977 for possible inclusion.
No.
Representative Finstad. Right. Representative Finstad, would you like to move your bill? I think this is one where we may be able to move fairly quickly and move it right to the floor, if I understand correctly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2050 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Thank you. Representative Finstad moved House File 2050 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Finstad, please proceed to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, this bill requires graduates of foreign medical schools applying to the Board of Medical Practice for a license to use a specified credential verification service, which is the Federation Credentials Verification Services. If the applicant uses this service, the physician application fee may be less than $200, but must not exceed the cost of administering the program, and the Board of Medical Practice estimates this to be about $75. This bill will save time, board time, and assure the board of accurate information and credentials. I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Any testimony?
Mr. Chair, my name is Robert Leach. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. I'm here to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Police, maybe you can just sort of inform the committee. I mean, I'm okay with it moving to the floor, but the fact is that there is a charge, and this is going into special revenue, which is sort of the purview, even if it's not general funds. But how does this compare to sort of where we would normally be? Well, I guess maybe just kind of give us a little bit of a sense of how this sits on your normal practices of fees.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Board of Medical Practice charges a $200 application fee to every applicant for medical licensure, whether they're a graduate of an American or Canadian medical school or an international medical school. So the actual application charge is not changing at all by the statement of $200 in this bill. What we are saying is that for those individuals who choose to use the Federation Credential Verification Service, whether they're a graduate of an American medical school or an international medical school, the board may lower the application fee for those individuals due to the fact that there is less staff-intensive work involved when the Federation is actually doing the verification of the prime or the core medical credentials.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for clarification. I think that makes it fairly straightforward. Any questions, members? Is there anyone here who wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one. Representative Finstead renews his motion that House File 2050 be recommended pass and be referred to the General Register. Do you understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Cox? I'll move that House File 2188. I think we'll begin with that, Representative Cox, if that's right with you. I'll move House File 2188. Representative Cox, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In view of the time of your committee, if you care to move the other bill too, we can take testimony from the same people.
It's going to take a different motion, so why don't we go ahead and handle this bill, and then we'll handle the other one with understanding that there is a relationship.
Yep, for the overlap. All right, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you today deals with intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded. I became involved with this issue during the last legislative session when copayment was passed to take effect this July. I firmly believe these larger ICFMRs are doing a great job serving their residents and that we need to keep them solvent and functioning well in order to give Minnesota residents and families a full range of option and care for their mentally retarded citizens. And that full range, as far as I know, should include waivered services, ICFMRs, group homes, and so forth that we are currently working with. I have two larger ICFMRs in my district. Laura Baker Services in Northfield is a 30-bed facility, and I have a 52-bed facility in Belle Plaine. House File 2188 repeals the 10% county copayments for these larger ICFMRs, and it also requires the Commissioner of Human Services to prepare a plan to deliver services to residents that are now being served by these larger ICFMRs. And the plan would be developed in consultation with families, consumer families, resident needs, and home administrators and other groups that are part of this whole effort. With that, I have a few people that would like to address the committee with me today, including Mr. Michael Klott, CEO of the Lutheran Home Association in Belle Plaine that operates the Hope Residence, and Bruce Nelson, Director of ARM, the Association of Residential Resources in Minnesota. And I'll maybe let Mr. Klott address you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Klott, and I serve as President of the Lutheran Home Association in Belle Plaine, where we own and operate a 52-bed ICFMR, the Hope Residence. Our organization was founded on this campus in 1898, and one of the components of our mission is providing services to persons with developmental disabilities. The Hope Residence is a unique ICFMR, and it is a home for residents referred to us throughout the state of Minnesota, often because they fall through the cracks in the system. Challenging diagnoses coupled with high medical complexities are common elements of those we serve. Individuals, families, county case managers, and other providers have seen this program fill a very special need, as many other programs are not equipped or do not take the individuals with these profound types of needs. Our ICFMR was among numerous providers that were threatened by the legislation passed last year, in which this partially shifted the cost of ICFMRs over six beds to counties that utilize these services. What we have found is that these counties do not have the resources to help with this shift. The passing of this legislation last year has been confirmed to be about money and resources, not philosophy of size. The intent of the legislation was not to arbitrarily close ICFMRs without any thought or pretext. Yet as some of our residents have passed away, we have not been able to fill these beds. We do, however, have referrals. Yet parents and case managers have been discouraged from placing in ICFMRs because the counties do not have the financial resources. Family members have told us of their desire to place at the Hope Residence, but some counties have even inferred that we might have to close because of this legislation and do not then make the decision to place their children. There's many examples that we could give you. Ironically, we had one yesterday take place where a couple came and toured our Hope Residence. The husband shared with me the desire to place his brother in our Hope Residence. However, he had been discouraged from another county in doing so partly because of these resource issues that are out there. In this case, his mother, who's been the primary caregiver and coordination of care, has terminal cancer, and the father is in a nursing home. And it's getting to a point of crisis, and it's really problematic for this family and the despair that it's creating. That is just but one example, and it is one of the examples of why we responded by developing special legislation unique to our program, House File 2073. However, we also strongly urge the passage of the complete repeal, House File 2188. We cannot underscore enough the threat to our organization, but more importantly, to persons with developmental disabilities and their families that this county cost shift has created. Families and individuals with developmental disabilities want real choices in housing, real choices in medical care, active treatment, and community involvement. Our team members devote their love and passion daily to make a profound difference to those we serve. We come to you to seek a critical emergency remedy to an area that cannot go another year without help. We come to you on behalf of our current and potential residents, many who cannot voice their opinion to you today. Today, many decisions of placement are bottled up, stalled in county agencies, and the burdens of families raise significantly. We urge your support of this bill to make an immediate, important decision to speak up to a most vulnerable group of citizens of our great state. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And the committee.
Mr. Nelson? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM. We represent providers and virtually all of the waivers, including and also just about every ICFMR provider in Minnesota. In your packet, you have a copy of a report that we prepared over the last many months, looking at what's happened to the ICFMR system, and in particular the county shift that you're addressing. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I truly do believe that this bill is attempting to address one of the unintended consequences of all of the work that you did last year to address the massive budget crisis. If you could indulge me for just a minute or two, I'd like to take you back to 1998 and very quickly, Mr. Chairman, run through what's happened to the ICFMR system going up to the action last year. From 1998 to the year 2000, there was a wonderful collaborative effort with advocates, providers, Department of Human Services to come up with a new payment system that would make the payment system simpler and closer to the consumer. And in doing that, providers actually gave up quite a bit. We gave up about $1.75 million and how you calculated the rates based on occupancy. We gave up the one-time rate adjustments, that's a facility-based adjustment, about $3.1 million, and old Rule 186, about $500,000, which provided for adjustments when people's needs changed. In doing that, we got a lot of things. We got a much better system. Representative Boudreau carried the bill here in the House. We streamlined downsizing, and there was $1 million allocated for that so that downsizing requests didn't have to come to the legislature. They could be done administratively. One of the core provisions that replaced OTRA, or one-time rate adjustments in Rule 186, was a profile-based automatic variable rate so that when a person's needs changed, There was an automatic mechanism through which the rates could be adjusted so that providers could deal with, say, a broken hip or whatever happened. There was a retirement formula built in so that people like all of us, when we reach that age and we retire, they could retire. There was a provision for open bed payments so that if a bed became open, there'd be a 90-day window where people would be, the bed would be paid for, going along with a planning process with the county, so the county could determine, do we want this resource or not in the system? And so that was in place. There was a minimum property. Been many, many years since property rates have been adjusted, so there was a minimum property rate established as well with legislation also that said there would be annual increases. There was a reduction of, and Mr. Chairman, you'll like this, and do more with less, but prior to this bill, the cost reports were about that thick that ICFSMR had to fill out. It was reduced to one page. So it was a wonderful thing that happened. And there was also, we put in place quality assurance plans that every ICFMR would prepare annually. And with the understanding that we don't want more bureaucracy, so there would be commensurate deregulation in other areas around the SLF rule or consolidated standards. Well, what's happened since then? Well, the state started to realize or see some deficits. And so many of these provisions, about four of them, have gone away. The downsizing is gone. The profile-based automatic variable rate is gone. All that's left is half the providers get a special needs variable rate that they have to apply for. It's just really like the old mechanism. The retirement formula is still there. The open payment mechanism is gone except for 25 crisis beds around the state. The minimum property rate is still there, but there have been no adjust increases, of course. The cost reports are still there. And that deregulation or regulatory reform that was promised or asked for never occurred relative to the county or the quality assurance plans. And so the upshot, members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, is that we gave up an awful lot to get something really good that was closer to the consumer, and most of the provisions have now gone away. And so it's been a real struggle for ICFSMR to hang in there and continue to provide supports to people with disabilities. Then came the massive crunch budget deficit of last year. And to help address that, ARM did suggest, and it was adopted, that we pay a tax, basically, a surcharge that would help draw down federal money, and we would stay whole. And the state got $1 million to help address the budget deficit that happened, and we were glad to do that and participate. More onerous, as Representative Cox and Mr. Clatt have pointed out, was that county shift. And we thank you, Mr. Chairman, for all the work that you did. Initially, the shift was to go into effect in January, and through negotiations, we were able to give us another 6 months so that we could come back here today and in this legislative session to try to address that. So as we look forward, you know, what's beginning to happen is a lot of unplanned closures of ICFSMR. People are essentially now being evicted from their homes. Counties, understandably, are taking action to close the larger ICFSMR, and because it is an extra cost with no benefit to them. And many counties are sitting on the fence waiting to see what happens here. So the bill before you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee would repeal the shift, and it would call for a study, as Representative Cox mentioned, of ICFSMR, of the people now living in them. What appears to us to have been happening is a definition of policy around ICFSMR through the last few years driven by short-term fiscal decisions. So what we're asking for is, well, do we want ICFSMR in Minnesota? If we do, let's study it and figure out how we can provide adequate resources for them. If we don't, let's look at that and assure that people who now live in ICFSMR have the supports they need to live full lives as citizens of the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you. I'm open for questions. Representative Cost, do you have any additional testifiers?
I don't believe I do.
I think it's been pretty well covered, so I'm not begging for it. I do have a couple of additional people on my list, though, that Commissioner Dave Norgaard from Lincoln County is here.
Okay.
And as they're coming down, Representative Cox, let me ask a question. In the subject of the plan and study, the delivery date I noticed is January 15, 2005, and I'm always sort of sensitive to information coming to the legislature when legislative sessions have already begun, and it becomes hard for it to be useful. I'm wondering if you would consider it friendly to change that to December 15, 2004 to give a little bit of lead time before legislative session begins.
I would be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
If you're all right with that, members, I would move on page 2, line 31, to strike January 15, 2005 and insert instead December 15, 2004. You understand that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman Bradley. It's fun to be back again.
We almost didn't let you in here. I would be terrible coming all the way from out there, huh?
Well, juggling other meetings, it was a long night, but it's nice to be back in front of your committee again.
Thank you.
I'm David Norgaard. I'm a Lincoln County Commissioner and a farmer, hog farmer. And I'm also the chair of our three-county Human Resources Department. I'm also the Social Services Subcommittee Chair for Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you for having me today. I'm here to testify in support of House File 2188, which is one of the top two human services legislative priorities for the counties for the year. And we thank Representative Cox for bringing forward this important initiative. We join with both the providers and advocacy groups in asking that this county share on ICF MR costs established last session be repealed. Counties have responded in good faith to establish the cost share by attempting to downsize, and we've done some of that in our three-county collaborative as well. And we certainly welcome the opportunity as outlined in Section 2 of the bill to discuss the desired policy direction relative to this type of facility, to take a look at what other options we could work on to bring a little bit more closure to this problem. It seems logical to decide affirmatively what the state sees as the appropriate role of the ICFs rather than to proceed with such a large cost shift absent of clear policy direction in the area. In our particular area, you kind of bump up against this ambiguous 7-bed number, and then we're awkwardly scrambling to find options to stay under that 7-bed option. And it could pose a significant cost shift in our three-county department of anywhere from $150,000 to $180,000 impact. And as you're aware, Chair Bradley, I'm a bean counter, and I watch those dollars pretty darn close. And we have done, and I understand that you folks had a phenomenal job last year and did an you did handsprings and performed miracles to balance that budget, and I applaud you for that effort. And we've done some changes in our three county departments to accommodate those shifts, and we did for the seventh year in a row did not increase our levy back to our three counties again. And not only that, but we did not use reserves to burn up reserves to get to that point either. We ended up at a zero. But this particular aspect could have a huge impact, and we're finding it as inventive and efficiencies as we are, almost impossible to accommodate this particular one and make it fit in anywhere. It doesn't have sound policy to back it up, and it's awkward at best in trying to find a shift on the ambiguous number of 7. To try to find a place for these individuals to fit in. In that respect, this particular bill probably, you know, needs to be looked at pretty handily, and I support the repeal of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No questions? Thank you for your testimony. Rick Hammer again.
Good
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly address our support for House File 2188. I'll try not to repeat anything that's already been said. I want to give you just a couple of brief overview ideas with regard to the effect that we have already seen with regard to the provisions of this bill. Excuse me. I'm Rick Hammergren. I'm the executive director for REM Minnesota. We're one of the largest provider of support services for persons with developmental disabilities in the state of Minnesota. And we provide services currently to 585 consumers in ICFMR programs in various communities throughout the state. Our greatest concern is that the cost shift to the counties of this 10% of the rate is being driven by cost containment and budget cutting strategies by the state, and in fact shifts some of the burden to the counties. And we think it's a wrong decision to let policy be driven by cost cutting strategy. And we would submit that we think that the department hasn't really considered the negative impact that this policy has already had on some consumers, even given that it doesn't really take effect until July of this year. We see that consumer choice is not being considered, and oftentimes, as you've heard previously, counties are making decisions based on having to dive below this magic number of six or fewer beds in order to avoid this cost shift. I'll give you a couple of brief examples of how this plays out for our organization. Historically, we had run at a 98% occupancy rate years and years, quarter over quarter. In the last quarter, our occupancy rate has dropped to below 94%. So county agencies are reluctant to place people in facilities where they know that coming July 1, they're going to have to start paying that cost shift. That exactly supports the previous testimony from Mr. Cox. We are closing four ICFMR facilities. That will be done, accomplished, before the end of this summer. One in Albert Lea and three in Bemidji. And it's not an accident that all of those facilities are licensed to serve seven or more people. I'm unaware of any six-bed ICFMR programs that are closing. So the facilities that are being targeted by county agencies for closure clearly are being chosen based on this cost shift strategy. Another brief point to consider is that many of our ICFs have been geared up to provide some specialized services. At the request of the Department of Human Services in the 90s, we converted several facilities from Class A to Class B, specifically designed buildings to accommodate people with special behavioral challenges who were being discharged from St. Peter. And we also developed some facilities specifically designed to serve people with medical conditions and mobility impairment. And we entered into developing these new services on a long-range plan. And now, less than 10 years into that plan, the funding is being threatened, the stability of those programs is being threatened, and the peace of mind and stability for the consumers we serve in those programs are being jeopardized. In recent weeks, I'm sure you've heard, and you heard this morning, that AMC and the Minnesota Social Service Association and the county social service directors support the provisions of this bill to repeal the cost shift and to support the study. I'd also like to echo that this morning we know we have strong support also from care providers, ARC of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. Recent indications are also that we believe in our discussions with DHS that they agree that the resolution of this matter and developing a thoughtful plan for the ICFMR system is warranted. So I urge you, please, to support the repeal of the cost shift of any ICFMR funding to the county agencies and vote in support of House File 2188. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Seeing none. Ms. Shill, could you help us? We don't have a fiscal note again. We have kind of a paper from the background, but maybe you can bridge what we see to be the fiscal impact of this proposal.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you have in your packet a sheet that looks like this. This came from the governor's proposal during the operating budget deliberations from last session. What you see there are fiscal impacts 04 through 07. If you recall what was actually enacted, we will begin the county share on large ICFMRs starting July 1, 04. So the fiscal impact that you see on that list for fiscal 04 would be zero. I have updates of numbers provided to me through a voicemail communication. The numbers are slightly a little bit different than what you see here. Cost impact for fiscal 05 would be $11,431,000. Cost impact for 06 would be $10,614,000. And for 07 would be $9,809,000. Plus, there is a slight $50,000 estimate for administration associated with this request. That's what we would be funding.
So I think we have the idea what the number is, somewhere in the 11 million or so range is what the first biennium would be the effect. Let me comment somewhat tangentially, but I can't help as a chair be disappointed in a bill that's dated February 13th and an issue that's been before us to be sitting in committee today without having a formal fiscal note. And to DHS and to finance, we have got to crank up our turnaround. We have to move. I can't backlog these bills anymore. But we've got to have a quicker response in bringing formal fiscal notes. I am not particularly proud of running through an important issue like this without having the benefit of a formal fiscal note. So let it be said here to DHS and to finance that we need your help. We need to do these things thoughtfully. With that said, I do want to make a little bit of a comment. I was part of putting this together, and frankly, yeah, I think in retrospect, sort of the one size fits all, because there's two parts. One is sort of the financial impact that the counties, I think, spoke very well to. And I think as we look at it now, I think we're seeing that the financial incentives that you'd expect have kind of a perverse effect, and that's not where we want to go, and we might not even get the savings, I wonder sometimes. But the other part is sort of the fundamental policy behind it. And we have been for years doing what's right in terms of sort of the notion of deinstitutionalizing. And I think that that was done with good thought. I'm not at all convinced, however, that taking a six-bed or eight-bed ICFMR that may be providing care to extremely medically fragile people and breaking that down into smaller groups where the care ends up being more expensive, and frankly, with the shortage of healthcare workers and so forth, that we're really doing what's right in that policy overall. And I commend you, Representative Cox, for not only sort of pushing the financial side of it, but I think also sort of pushing the policy side of it. It really is time for us to take a hard look at where we are today. We're not in the old days of sort of the strict institution, and I don't know if thinking of something that has seven or more beds as an institution is where our heads ought to be today. So I thank you very much for it. It's still a lot of money, but I think it's a great piece of work, and I commend you for bringing that forward. Any question, members? President Adler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of touched on my question, and I think we agree that we're on the right. This bill could pass, but I'm for the Department and Finance. I presume they're out there, and I don't know why they aren't going to talk to us. But I would hope that they would, when they do their fiscal note, that they'll look at the counties that aren't going to shift people. It looks to me like they were expecting kind of a straight line using of services, and 20% of that would be the amount that that budget would benefit by. And from what I hear, that's not the case. And so I'm concerned that our forecast is soft in terms of what we're saving. And so when the fiscal note comes back, I think we'll discover good news and bad news, that the savings were less than we thought, but it's cheaper to do this than we think. And so I hope that that'll be reflected in the real fiscal note.
Thank you. We no further questions. The motion before us, I'll renew, is that House File 2188 be considered for possible inclusion in our bill. Any further discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cox. And you have another bill, which hopefully we can do fairly quickly. I think it's kind of a local addendum to this. Representative Cox, I'll move that House File 2073 be considered for possible inclusion. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And you're correct, and you should have a fiscal note on this one on the yellow sheets before you. I'm not going to go into all the much of the testimony that we just heard on House File 2188 applies to House File 2073. 2073 is a smaller version that essentially applies to a home in Scott County. This, as I said earlier, this whole matter came to my attention as we were working on this last year over the summer. I spent a fair amount of time dealing with the homes in Northfield and the homes in Belle Plaine, looking at them. And I would like to thank Chairman Bradley for the comments he made about the policy issue. I think this is a big part of this, in that how we are delivering services to these individuals. As I looked at the Hope's residents in Belle Plaine, in my other life, I'm a contractor, folks, and I could see how you could take that building and break it up, pull out some walls, put some doors in, create maybe six unit facilities, and maybe disconnect them and go through a whole bunch of mechanisms to meet the needs of the being driven down into a six bed model. But when I look at what they're doing over there and how they're serving the needs of the residents that they have there, you know, I just really came to the conclusion we should not be going that route. And that's where this bill came before you, because at a minimum I felt I really needed to do all I could to address the concerns of that home so that it doesn't close, because I think you heard testimony from others today that that is a risk. And if these homes close, where are these people going to go? The average age of the resident in the Hope Center is 54, I believe. These are not young people that can just be put in a group home setting or whatever. They're older. They're getting great care, and I want to see that that's continued. Again, I have Mr. Mike Klatt with me, and if he cares to add anything to what I just said.
I think only one question. I'm assuming if we pass House File 2188, we don't need House File 2073.
That's correct,
Chairman.
I'm motivated.
So are we. Thank you.
Any further discussions? Hearing none, we'll lay House File 2073 over for possible consideration.
Thank you, Representative Cox. Thank you, Member.
Representative Heidrichen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'll move the bill.
Oh, Representative Abler moves House File 2639 for possible inclusion. Representative Heidrichen, can you get
Thank you, Mr.
the
Chair.
Preferred version?
Representative Bud Heidrichen. I'm presenting the bill that's been presented here a couple times before. It's House File 2639. It's much the same bill that passed in 2002 and 2003. And basically, it's to move the St. Cloud area nursing homes into a metropolitan classification for purposes of establishing reimbursement rates. Representative Opatz is a co-author of this bill, and Senator Dean Johnson is carrying it in the Senate. If we recall the testimony from last year, we have significant parts of northern Minnesota, the Rochester area, the Moorhead area, all of which have received metropolitan designation for purposes of nursing home rates. The St. Cloud area is more metropolitan in character than many of the areas currently designated as metropolitan. We are closer to the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and our nursing homes are struggling to pay Twin City wage rates in order to hire and retain employees. With that, Mr. Chairman, members, I have with me three nursing home administrators, Mr. Phil Lord, Mr. Mark Anderson, and Mr. Robert Wickham, who is up here with me today, who will talk a little bit more about the circumstances of the St. Cloud area nursing homes, and then we'll answer any questions there may be.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Bob Wickham, and I am the administrator of Mother of Mercy Campus of Care in Albany, Minnesota. I am here today speaking on behalf of approximately 13 nursing homes in the St. Cloud metropolitan area. These homes have come together in support of Representative Heidgerken's bill, HF 2639. As Representative Heidgerken mentioned, the St. Cloud area is the only metropolitan area whose long-term care facilities do not receive metropolitan rates. Our concerns about receiving non-metro rates are not a new issue. Nursing homes from the St. Cloud area have petitioned the legislature for many years seeking metropolitan designation in the long-term care reimbursement system. In fact, it passed in the House last year. The bill relies upon an objective measure of what constitutes a metropolitan area. We are tying into the latest census data and designations made by the United States Office of Management and Budget. The St. Cloud area is the closest of greater Minnesota metropolitan areas to the seven-county metro area. For some time, our wage rates have been influenced by those in the Twin Cities. Increasingly, our nursing homes are finding it difficult to hire and retain nursing staff in order to meet staffing requirements. There have been new clinic operations established in the St. Cloud area which offer very competitive wages for day shift work. Nursing homes such as ours must not only compete with these wage rates, but must meet staffing standards on a 24-hour basis. Our long-term care reimbursement system has evolved over a period of 15 to 20 years. In the course of this evolution, the St. Cloud area has missed opportunities to be recognized as a for the metropolitan character of its labor market and wage rates. In the meantime, every other federally designated metropolitan area has been recognized in the long-term care payment system as metropolitan. In fact, some areas that are not specifically within federally designated metropolitan areas are designated metropolitan for purposes of nursing home payments. It is not our intention to affect any of these other facilities. We are simply looking to include all metropolitan areas within the meaning of metropolitan for purposes of Minnesota's nursing facility payment system. Going forward, we feel it is appropriate to use the objective criteria established by the Office of Management and Budget and the latest United States Census data to determine metropolitan areas for purposes of the long-term care payment system. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Representative Heidgerken's bill. I would be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. It's my observation, having gone through this, that and you probably have done this, that if you survey the cost drivers in your area, you'll probably find that they match kind of the metropolitan cost drivers, that is, the competition of the healthcare workers and so forth. Is that a fair observation?
That is fair. We have to compete with the St. Cloud Hospital, which I understand pays the about 95% of what the Twin Cities hospitals pay their employees.
Thank you. President Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think he's slightly wrong there, because my understanding is the St. Cloud Hospital actually pays a little teeny bit more. than the Twin Cities, at least for our ends. They're basically the same labor market. But I had a question for Mr. Heidgerken.
Please proceed, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative, why do you think you're going to have better luck with this than Representative Knobloch?
Representative Heidgerken?
Yeah, my ace in the hole is my state senator is Dean Johnson, and I got him carried over at the Senate, and I think an awful lot.
Mr. Chair and members, I've supported this in the past, and it doesn't make any sense to have the payment system in St. Cloud be less than the Twin Cities or less than Duluth. They're the same labor market, mm-hmm. pay the same wages. Doesn't make sense.
Well, I think it's a sign, members, our rate system for nursing homes is simply broke. And it's an unworkable. Now, the good news, folks, there is coming forth this session. I don't know that we're going to get all the way, but there is a new rate system, which I think has some sort of exciting characteristics to be efficiency and quality based. So maybe we'll work our way out of this. But in the meantime, this makes sense. Representative Lopez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to thank Representative Heidgerken for attempting to move this forward. I suppose this is a funny question coming from me, but when you just say the St. Cloud area, what does that mean in this regard? We use the St. Cloud area, we describe it differently for different purposes, and whether it's St. Cloud area airport, and well, that might define a mm-hmm. certain region. So I'm just curious, yeah. what is defined?
Mr. Chair. My understanding is it would be Stearns County, Benton, and Sherman.
Okay, so the three yeah. county. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. The fiscal note that we have, which actually I believe harkens back to last year, so I don't think we've got an updated fiscal note again. However, it shows zero, and it seems to be because there's some discretion allowed. It seems to me, however, if in fact it was implemented, there would in fact be cost. I mean, mm-hmm. if you raise mm-hmm. people's rates, it's got to cost something. I mm-hmm. don't think we found any magic yet. So with my suggestion, and I would like a little help from the department on this, because I would like to know what would be the cost if, in fact, it happens. And the only way I can see that it's avoided, maybe if there's somebody who can speak to that, I'd appreciate it, because if it's done, it's got to cost something. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Greg Zabel. I'm from the Department of Human Services. The reason that we put a zero fiscal note on this bill is that
As it stands by itself, it does not create any new spending. If a bill is passed sometime in the future that increases nursing home rates, it will change how the money goes to the different facilities, but it won't change the total amount that is spent. So if a bill was put forth that was going to spend $5 million in nursing home money, if this bill is passed as well, then that $5 million will be distributed differently with the passage of this bill as opposed to without.
Got it. Thank you.
We were hoping you weren't going to ask that.
Well, a finance chair does have to be careful. it would be my suggestion, thank you, I think that's sufficient information. Representative Heikirken, it's certainly up to the author, but I would be open to holding this over, and I can assure you that we do have, and I think we will have, some sort of a supplemental bill to be included in a supplemental bill. If that helps give you a better chance, I'm open to doing that. If you want to have it run separately, because technically there's no fiscal note, mm-hmm. I'm open to either option, but I want to help you try to pass it if I can.
Thank you.
What would you prefer?
Well, if we're to have a field, that would be the best chance. I agree with
okay.
you.
Okay. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. If there's no further questions and no one else wishes to testify, see no one, I'll renew my motion that House File, I'm sorry, Representative Abel renews his motion that House File 2639 be considered for possible inclusion. Thank you. Now, Representative Dorman. Welcome to the committee, Representative Dorman. Please proceed with your bill. Well, I'll say I'll move House File 2612 for possible. It's got to go taxes. I'll move that House File 2612 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I believe this is the first time I've had the honor to come before your committee.
And I don't see any goodies or any kind
nothing,
of things.
Nothing. Well, I'm on a new diet, Mr. Chair. It's the Atkins Plus, and I recommend the members take a look at that. It's everything you can eat on the Atkins diet plus whatever the heck you want. I'll say heck. So it's working out for me, but, you know, you all do what you want. Before you... I brought House File 2612, which takes a look at the provider tax or the sick tax or, you know, whatever we want to refer to it as it affects pharmacists and drug wholesalers in the state of Minnesota. About a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, I got a visit, as I'm sure many of you did, from a local pharmacist in the Elberly area. Guy that I respect. I thought he was a pretty smart guy, but he opened a second pharmacy, and I thought, wow, there's a guy, you know, he doesn't need to go to Vegas because he gambles every day trying to make a pharmacy work in rural Minnesota. So he's expanded into a second pharmacy, and we got talking about the difficulties of small businesses, being a small business person myself, trying to make a go of it, and I learned an awful lot from him about, you know, how much he gets paid to fill a prescription, and we got talking about the Pharmacy RX or Drug RX or the Canadian Drug website. I'm not sure exactly what its official name is, that is being promoted by Governor Puente, and trying to respond to the high cost of prescription drugs. And what he brought up to me, and I didn't realize, was that the providers of the drugs on that website are not required to collect or pay the provider tax. And I'd say there's a bunch of regulations that our guys have that they don't have. That aside, it seems to me that if it is a good enough policy for those two Canadian pharmacies, it ought to be a good enough policy for our local folks, too, who are trying to live and thrive and survive. And I don't mean to always say, it's, you know, look at everything from a rural perspective, but I would plead guilty of that. And I'd say that in rural Minnesota, we have a higher percentage of independent operators still trying to make it. You know, not everybody's buying their drugs at Target or Walmart or wherever. You know, we still have local people in our communities trying to survive. And so I put a bill in that would say, good for the goose, good for the gander. Let's exempt the sick tax from these pharmacists and give them the ability to compete. To my right, we have Liz Carpenter from the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. She was kind enough to come down and testify, and I would have had a couple pharmacists, Chair Bradley, but they just couldn't get here today, but I'm very thankful for the opportunity to get a hearing.
Carpenter, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Liz Carpenter, and I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today and testify in support of House File 2612. As Representative Dorman said, this bill would repeal the 2% wholesale drug distributor tax. Under current law, this tax is paid by Minnesota pharmacies when they purchase their inventory, and it's remitted to the state by the prescription drug wholesalers they buy from. The pharmacy is then allowed to pass the tax on to those who purchase the drugs from the pharmacies, with a couple of exceptions. Pharmacists are not reimbursed by the state for enrollees in state programs, and pharmacists are seeing an increase in out-of-state pharmacy benefit management companies who are refusing to reimburse the tax. We've had some difficulty in getting the pass-through provision enforced because there's no regulation of these companies by either revenue or commerce. Throughout the past 6 months, pharmacists have expressed concern over the drive to encourage people to purchase their drugs from Canada. Pharmacists have objected to the personal importation proposals because they contribute to the precarious position that the pharmacies are already facing. At the present time, importation of drugs from Canada is not recognized as legal by either the FDA or pharmacist liability insurers, and as such, pharmacists aren't covered for any activities related to imported drugs or the importing of prescription drugs. It's important that policymakers understand that unless the federal laws are changed, Minnesota pharmacists are completely cut out of any plans having to do with importation and are unable to access Canadian prices when purchasing their inventory. With the state's endorsement of importation from Canada, Minnesota pharmacists are being put at a distinct competitive disadvantage. The 2% wholesale drug distributor tax contributes to this problem. For the past 3 years, we've presented data in this committee that shows that pharmacies are not the cost drivers in the prescription drug budgets. Pharmacies in Minnesota are operating on net profit margins between 2 and 3%, and much of their business continues to be diverted to mail order pharmacies. Additionally, reimbursement from both public and private entities continues to be forced down, in many cases, below the pharmacy's cost of dispensing the prescription. The Minnesota Pharmacists Association supports Representative Dorman's efforts to take immediate action to reduce the cost of prescription drugs by 2% for all Minnesotans. And while the playing field between Minnesota pharmacies and Canadian pharmacies cannot be leveled unless federal importation laws are changed, we believe that House File 2612 would provide some relief in bridging the gap that Minnesota pharmacies are facing when trying to compete with the state-endorsed Canadian pharmacies. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any additional testimony from anyone?
Mr. Chair, there is not.
Okay, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, what is the effect of if this passes on the health care access fund? How many dollars will they lose?
I think Ms. Schill can give us a kind of a size, and unfortunately, again, we don't have all the, in fairness, we didn't put this on the schedule until just a couple days ago, so, but I think Ms. Schill has some numbers.
Members in committee, once again, I received some information early this morning with respect to revenues coming through Healthcare Access Fund. This would be a subcomponent of the 2% provider tax. And Representative Dorman, this is an update from information that I phoned to your office yesterday as well. From the February 04 forecast, the amount of money anticipated to come into Healthcare Access Fund due to the wholesale drug tax, okay, and I will start with 05 because that's what we're looking at. It would be $78.6 million, or approximately 21.8% of the overall component of the 2% provider tax. For 06, yeah, we're going to get into numbers with this fiscal note, there's no question. For 06, the wholesale drug tax is $87.5 million, and for 07, it's $98.8 million. Now, there's one other caveat to this that we need to think about or at least look in the fiscal note, and this is actually from Paul Wilson, who is our staff economist and works with the Taxes Committee. His comment is, when a hospital buys drugs, will it then pay the tax if this is implemented? Currently, there is a tax that exists, and it is paid right now through the wholesale process. If the wholesale process is eliminated, then there's another point in which the tax could be collected, either at the hospital or surgical center level. So these numbers that I gave to you could go down, depending on how the outcome is in application. That's what I know now.
Well, Mr. Chair, $98 million is probably 25% of the health care access fund income. And so Representative Dorman, how many kids do you want to kick off of Minnesota Care?
Representative Dorman?
Representative Bradley and Representative Huntley, I don't want to kick any kids off Minnesota Care. I think we ought to look at other ways that we fund that program other than this tax, because I would suggest that those numbers might go down and are going to go down because of market forces going on as people either import drugs from Canada and we don't pick up the 2%, or they go to mail order outside of the state and we don't pick it up. So I think we're headed down that road anyway, and we really ought to start addressing that and say, you know, these programs are important. Let's find a way to get a very stable source of revenue. I don't think this is the stable source of revenue. It might look good now, but I think it's gonna continue. So to answer your question directly, I don't want to kick any kids off, but without a change, we're gonna have problems in that fund anyway.
Mr. Motley?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dorman, we're faced with your bill, and we have to look at what your bill does. And your bill would devastate the Minnesota Care program. And you can talk about what we might do in some other bills, but we have to deal with your bill. And I'm not certainly willing to support something that's going to eliminate 25% or whatever of the people on Minnesota Care. I mean, last year we took away glucose strips from diabetics in care, and I don't know what, now we're just going to kick them off.
President Bieber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the whole point of the size of the fiscal note is, maybe you can use my advice and advice to the authors, this goes on. Is there a way to scale this to a pharmacies of a certain size? Like, I know you can do special tax rates for zip codes on some of these increment financing projects, and perhaps advice to the authors, there is a way to scale this so that it would target some of the most vulnerable rural pharmacies that we're trying to protect, and some of the metro ones have more economies of scale and more collateral access. Just a thought as this goes forward. It might reduce this to a couple $1 million.
Representative Dorman, any response to the scalability?
I would imagine, Mr. Chair, that it would be, and Representative Abler, that it would be. And you know, if I put my real hat back on, I'll tell you that this, you know, this impacts folks in rural Minnesota, pharmacists in rural Minnesota, I think more than here. And I'm not picking on large corporations like Walmart or Target or something, but sometimes I think that people get the impression that, and I would imagine they are really selling the bulk of the drugs in the state, but they're, you know, I worry about the small guy still trying to survive. To the other comment, Mr. Chair, this does actually have a cost, and when it gets to the tax committee, if it does, you know, I think we need to find a way to backfill it. We certainly just shouldn't raid the healthcare access account, whether it's your provision to increase the tobacco tax or whatever. I mean, we do have to, at some point, have to find the dollars. We simply just can't pull them out.
Representative Kremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is in relation to the healthcare access fund. And that used to be a place that was pretty sacred, and it was only for Minnesota Care. But last year, the governor took several hundred million out, and in his new budget, he's taking another $70 million out of the healthcare access fund. So, since it's not even sacred anymore, I'm not sure that this whole discussion about saving Minnesota Care is even. I mean, it's another dollar amount for you, but I also looked at the governor's budget and what kind of percentage that he's reducing even out of pharmaceutical wholesale dollars. So I think if we could say that the healthcare access fund was absolutely not to be touched only by Minnesota Care, that would be one thing, but we're losing the money anyway?
Well, let's come back to the subject of the bill. Representative Dorman, I mean, I can't, as a chairman of this committee, in good faith, pass this on with recommendation unless I know that we've got some alternative funding, or at least an outlook with the Healthcare Access Fund as to the health of the Healthcare Fund. And I know this much. I know that the Healthcare Access Fund could not sustain this kind of reduction in its revenues and still provide the support, even if we were held to the Minnesota Care Program. So I'm a little bit troubled. I mean, I certainly easily enough could modify my motion, but I think if it does leave this committee successfully, and I'm really troubled with even my own personal vote on this, Representative Dorman, I'm very sympathetic. I don't think there's anybody that's fought harder to get rid of the provider tax entirely than I have, and Representative Huntley's been a great partner in doing that. However, we do have some responsibilities, and every time we've had a proposal, we've had that accompanied in some kind of way that sustained the funding necessary to maintain the Minnesota Care Program. And at this point, you have a bill in front of us that doesn't have that other half. So I'm sort of troubled. So my suggestion would be this. One, that I modified to send it without recommendation. And two, that I'd have to keep a string from this committee's point of view, and with the prerogative to call it back to us and to see how things balance. The tax committee could make a judgment, but they don't have to pay for it. We're the committee that's caught with that. So I'm willing on a personal level. Now, I can't assure how the votes in the committee will be, Representative Dorman, but I would need to have those two caveats. One, I think it needs to move out of here without recommendation. And two, that I maintain the right to call it back here again to be sure that we've had a way to balance it. Are you able to accept those provisions?
Mr. Chair, members, absolutely, and would work with you in any way possible to bring it back if it looked like this was just going to end up as a raid on the healthcare access account, because that's not my intent. I think this is an important issue that we need to keep pushing. I'm also a realist. I understand what the budget situation is currently, but if we don't keep pushing on this issue, I'm afraid eventually we are going to end up in a situation where that healthcare access account doesn't have the money in it to provide Minnesota care. So, looking at the next bill on your calendar, Mr. Chair, I think that I look at this able to help you, saying, "Hey, let's look at another way to fund that, whether it's increase in tobacco or other things." I really believe that we ought to, what about dementia assessment for the same reason? I think that that's starting to diminish too, and we better start thinking now about ways to fund this until they're in a real crisis.
Hey, with that, let me open up. I mean, I'll change my motion when I renew it, but is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? Well, Representative Norris?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add, I would like to see the author really work hard as he goes forward to target this to the small rural pharmacies, if there's a way to do that, if that helps you to also have less impact when it comes to funding it.
Thank you. And further discussion. I'll alter my motion to recommend House File 2612 that be moved to the Committee on Taxes without recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I very much appreciate it.
We're having a little discussion about House File 1977. Apparently, we acted on a bill that's different than was modified in government operations. Representative Bajor, can you give us a little enlightenment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I would just verify that. House File 1977 was modified in government operations, and the changes are reflected in the summary, but not in the language. And I think that Mr. Chun is getting us a copy of the modified language.
Okay.
So we can just...
Well, we'll see if you can get back. I'm going to make a shot. I realize we only have a couple of minutes, but I'd like to at least put 2533 in front of the committee. Why don't I just do it from here? Let's see if we can pull this off. I'll move that House File 2533 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. And members, this is a fairly straightforward bill. It has two elements to it. One element would raise the tobacco tax by 30 cents to offset the MCHA assessment. The current MCHA assessment is in the range of about $88 million. I think people know that that MCHA assessment disproportionately falls in the end on small businesses where our most acute problems are as far as being able to continue to provide insurance. I know that there may be some degree of controversy, and I'm not going to get into the sort of the controlling, smoking, those kinds of things, which may be part. But I do think that it's really important from a healthcare cost point of view, particularly among small employers, to give some relief. So one piece of relief would be that we eliminate this, and I would also sort of put a plug in. I know that there's also a bill which has some MCHA reforms in it, which I think would help maybe hold down some of those costs. But at least at the outset, this would take care of where we are currently in the assessment that's made. And we leave the language in statute that would allow incremental additions using the premium tax if it's necessary, if the the shortfall occurs, so we have to finance it. So that, I think that makes that complete. The other part that this bill does is it lowers the provider tax by 0.25%. And in keeping with the discussion in the that we just had, my sense is, and I'm trying to force that we get a legitimate fiscal note on this, because I'm of a mind that because of things that are happening in our waivers and other areas, we're probably going to see a number of people moving from Minnesota Care to MA and some other dynamics, that I think we may very well have what I would call kind of a structural surplus. That will either work or not. I mean, I don't change from my own self the obligation to maintain the funding stream that we need for Minnesota Care. But I think it's a good time to sort of test the water. Now, I realize this runs in opposition to, and we'll have to reconcile those when we finalize the budget. The governor has recommended, I believe, transferring something like $70 million from the Healthcare Access Fund, and we haven't reconciled that yet, but all these things have to reconcile. So, members, that's basically it. And, Michelle, I don't know if you have any sort of more details on what the numbers mean.
Mr. Chair, I have a number of... different scenarios associated with House File 2533. What I will say is this, the preliminary fiscal estimate also done by Paul Wilson, who works with the Taxes Committee, was done with the one-quarter provider tax cut. And at the time, we based it on the November forecast numbers, and it all worked. Until, of course, the release of the February forecast, where there were changes to the calculations associated with the Healthcare Access Fund and monies that would be required. So right now, there is a reworking in progress of what the figures actually look like. Of course, the MCHA figures 88.65 for 06, for each 06, 07, stay the same, but monies available in Healthcare Access Fund have been moving, and we're studying that right now to see exactly what that means. So when I'm given more direction on which way to go to make up, for example, the loss associated with the new forecast in the Healthcare Access Fund would either cause us to increase the cigarette tax, for example, more than the 29 cents that you see in the bill, or perhaps decrease the provider tax cut, not by 0.25%, but maybe from 2% to 1.85 instead of 1.75. We have some preliminary figures on this, and I'll just look for further direction as we deliberate this further.
Yeah, Michelle and members, let me be sort of clear. I know there's been some confusion on this. It is my intent to sort of keep those separate. I wasn't trying to use the tobacco tax as revenue to offset the provider tax. I was testing where we are. If my numbers are right, I think that the yearly amount would probably be something less than $40 million. And I know we just had a discussion about $98 million, but I'm of a mind that we can actually handle that there's structural. Now, we'll know when we get better analysis long term. But I was not trying to make a connection to say that we'll raise the tobacco tax proportionally if we need to. It will either stand or not on its own, and it'll be a matter of fiscal analysis as far as how much we could afford to make. And by the way, my proposal would be that we make it permanent. I'm not very interested in sort of click off, click on kind of thing. I think we all got criticized when the provider tax went back up 0.5%. At least I know I did. I got criticized from people, why are you raising a provider tax when, in fact, we had temporarily brought it down? It just doesn't seem to work that way. So what I'm trying to exercise here is let's at least test the water with the changes that are happening in our health care access fund and our programs in relation to see if there's a little bit of room to take a bite out of the provider tax. Simple as that. Representative Putney?
Well, Mr. Chair, you're probably not surprised that I support this bill.
Oh, cool. by the way, I'd welcome additional authors. We kind of rushed to get something in, and I certainly welcome if other people want to sign on. Sure.
I'll do that tomorrow. There is only, in my mind, one tax worse than the provider tax, and that's the MSHA tax. At least the provider tax hits everybody that buys health care, but the MSHA tax only hits small businesses or individuals that buy their insurance by themselves. And so it's a very unfair tax. I also like raising the price of tobacco because it will stop kids from smoking. So both parts of this bill I love.
It's kumbaya. I love it. Is there anybody in the audience that would wish to testify regarding this bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm with the law firm of Gray Plant Moody, and I represent UST Public Affairs, which manufactures Copenhagen and Skoal, other tobacco products. I'd like to bring your attention to the way that other tobacco products are taxed. It's not the same as cigarettes. And we pay a percentage of the wholesale price. Right now it's 35%, and it has been for quite some time. And since it is based on wholesale price, every time there's a price increase in our tobacco products, the amount of tax the state collects increases. For example, in 1993, the tax on a pack of cigarettes was 48 cents, and a tax on a can of Copenhagen premium brand was about 54 cents a can. With the natural price increases that have occurred over the last dozen years or so, 10 years, that price is per can of just the excise tax is now 98 cents a can. So we've seen a 44 cents percent cents a can increase just on that, basically an 81% increase. That's not the only tax that's paid on it. We also pay a sales tax of 33 cents a can. And if there's a local sales tax of 1%, in some communities it's another 5 cents, so $1.36 a can. The proposal you have would raise the price, the tax collected on a can to $1.32 a can. The sales tax would increase to 36 cents, and with a local sales tax, when there is one, of 5 cents, the price, the taxes we would then pay on a can is $1.73. Now, what's happened in other states when they've increased the rates unreasonably high, and New Jersey is an example, they raised their rate to 48%, and in 1997, their collections actually decreased. They lowered the tax to 30% in 2002, and their collections increased. And the point I want to make is that if you're counting on this money to cover some other costs, I don't think you're looking in the right spot. The other trade-off is we have the cross-border issue, which I'll get into, but also there are what they call value brands. And if somebody buys a cheaper can of chewing tobacco, they pay less taxes. For example, on what we call value brands, the average retail price is about $3.57 a can currently, where on Copenhagen School is about $5.36. People will substitute. And the tax effect on a value brand is 65 cents versus 98 cents. So people switch. So I think you have to look at those numbers. And and if you increase it, I can go to the numbers, but I won't go into that. Also, because of this, it's a percentage of the wholesale price, the collections the state has had has gone up 47% in the last 10 years. They've gone from a little under $8 million, or under $9 million, to about $18 million. So it's been a pretty good increase in it, just the way it is. Also, we have another factor, the comparison to the states around us. Our rates would be substantially higher. In Minnesota, as I said, average retail price for premium can is about $5.36. In South Dakota, the tax is 10% or 28 cents a can. It's $4.25. In Iowa, it's 62 cents a can. In Wisconsin, 70 cents a can. Under this proposal, we would even have a greater disparity. People can go across the border and buy our products rather quickly.
Excuse me, Mr. Tennyson, we're sort of run out of time, and we will be reviewing those things in the tax committee as well, and I'm certainly willing to work with you. We take sort of a standard formula, but we will have another opportunity to discuss those points you're making.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll wrap it up. In terms of the point raised by Mr. Huntley, the fact is that the trends have shown that consumption is down, and it's trending down, and that's by the Center for Disease Control and other studies. But anyway, I would encourage you to not support this bill. I don't, at least take our product out of it, because I don't think you're going to get what you want out of it anyway. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
No questions.
Thank you.
I'll renew my motion that House file. I'm sorry, Representative Huntley.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I received a note yesterday from one of the, what I assume is tobacco lobbyist, pointing out that revenues from tobacco taxes have gone down in California. And I haven't heard anybody from California complaining about that. That means people are smoking less. And if you look at Minnesota, we spend the cost of the state of tobacco-related illnesses is $2.5 billion. And some of that we pay through medical assistance and some of it through other state programs. So anything we do that decreases smoking, even though that will might cause some problems in Minnesota care, if we're using that as a source of money, is a benefit to the state. And it's quite clear that kids in particular are more sensitive to tobacco prices than adults. And if prices go up, amount of smoking is going to go down.
We renew my motion on House File 2533. We recommend to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Now let's try to quickly handle 1977. As I recall, the motion that I made was that House File 1977 be considered for possible inclusion. And I didn't indicate any level. If staff has any recommendations, do I need to modify the motion or reconsider in order to be able to pick up fact, or would my motion already sort of assume that we're using the latest level?
Mr. Chair, my understanding, and I wasn't covering this bill, was that the actual text of the first engrossment may not have been before the committee?
Right. That's correct.
So given that, it may be safer just to clarify that it is the first engrossment that you're making the motion.
Okay. If I can just do that by indicating that it was my intention in the motion to refer to the first engrossment for the record?
I think so.
Understood? All right. I'll just do it that way. Our next meeting Thursday is going to be policy. The remainder of the weekend is going to be policy work with lots and lots of bills. So our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 16th. Well, for the business, we adjourn.